I want to shift from the overview that Jason gave us to considering the processes that produce the sediment that we call till. So for this, we're going to turn to Carrie Jennings, who's the Research and Policy Director at the Freshwater Society. Carrie has 25 years of experience mapping and research in glacial sediments, during which time she also taught glacial geology at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere. Carrie obtained her BA from Northwestern and a master's and PhD from the University of Minnesota. Carrie, over to you.
Thank you. Is this on? Okay, are we live? So I submitted this abstract. I submitted this title and this abstract during one of those blizzards, and I thought the title was kind of funny at the time. It really was an ode to Thomas Hobbes, Till, Solitary, Poor, Nasty, Brutish, and Short. You know, I thought it was kind of funny, but now I'm questioning my state of mind at that time. But I do want to emphasize the variability of till and the complexity of the record, and also the density, because that has a bearing on the record. I think for the length of my career, we've struggled to really explain how we got so much till in Minnesota. This is on the Yellow Medicine River out by Granite Falls in Upper Sioux Agency State Park and represents about 1 million years worth of glacial sediment. We have been glaciated for 2.5 million years. We don't seem to have a lot of the older tills preserved, maybe only in deep valleys, but here I think it's important to recognize that what we often, do I have a pointer? Yeah, here we go. What we often talk about in the Minnesota River watershed, the Des Moines lobe till, is the upper 2 meters of this section. So the rest of the section there is important also to understand, in particular right now because there's a landslide happening midway in that section on Highway 67 that's affecting the entrance to the park. MnDOT engineers are calling it Des Moines lobe till, but it's probably facilitated by some spring activity partway down between some much older sediment layers, some much older glacial layers. So we have to explain these, and we're kind of focused at the surface on the last little blue spikes to the left, stage 2 and 4, marine isotope stage 2 and 4, which are their two most recent glaciations kind of smashed together early and late Wisconsin, and you might have referred to them by an earlier terminology, but every single one of those blue spikes down to, down to there is part of the record of the Pleistocene glaciation. And if you look closely at that diagram, you'll see that that actually says Pliocene. Since 2005, we moved the base of the Pleistocene back a little bit. It used to be closer to 2 million years. Now it's 2.58. So most of this reversed magnetic cron down to the Matiyama-Goss boundary is going to be Pleistocene. This is important in our record because we can actually use magnetic stratigraphy to date some of these things. If they're reversed, then we can say that they're older than the last magnetic reversal at 770,000 years ago. And this is something you can determine about tills. So it's most likely that it's the larger blue spikes, and I could point to both of you, the larger blue spikes that are recorded in the upper Midwest here. At least those are the ones that are more extensive and more likely to be preserved. The less extensive, those actually, the size of the spike refers to the volume of ice on the planet or the volume missing from the ocean. So the lesser ones might not have gotten as far south in the mid-continent as the later ones. So we certainly have stage 2 and 4, 6, probably 12 and 18 recognized in Minnesota. So we've kind of thrown out that old chronology of Wisconsin, Illinois, and Kansas, and Nebraska. There are tills exposed in those states, but those terms are not typically used anymore. So what we have in Minnesota, and don't freak out by the complexity of this table, this is kind of, Barb's going to talk about this. I'm just putting this up here to say, there's a lot of tills in Minnesota. You might know the New Ulm Formation. Let's see where I'm going to even be able to see it. Southwest, New Ulm Formation. It's one of these green blobs. And then Cromwell Formation would be one of the red blobs here. Those are the tills of the Des Moines Lobe and the Superior Lobe, as you know them at the surface. And even those formations are recognizable in the field. Members are something you might have to do a little more work to define. Even those are separated into members that can be identified and traced laterally across the state. And all those other boxes represent distinct lithostratigraphic units that are present in these different regions. We've had to separate the state out into different regions because the tills aren't laterally extensive across the entire state. So pick your region, southwest or central, and you can see that in that section I showed you in the upper Minnesota River Valley, you were looking at a stack of tills down to about here. None of them were magnetically reversed. That would be stage 18 or older, although there are tills in this part of Minnesota and in Wisconsin that are reversed magnetically. So there's a lot to know. If you are working at the surface, you probably are only working in the last stage of glaciation and can rely on some very simple layers. But if you're going deeper than maybe, well, 2 meters in the upper Minnesota River Valley, or, you know, 40 feet in a morainic complex, then you're down into a different unit. So I want to focus, however, on glacial processes because each one of these units is was created independently by an ice advance and has specific characteristics related to that ice advance. And glaciology was my first degree. That's the physics of ice movement, and those are the processes that you need to understand to figure out why ice came in the first place. A lot of times, glaciologists are physicists or material scientists. Sometimes they're geologists. And then glacial geology is the sedimentary record of glaciation. That was what I did my PhD in. And I feel like this is the equivalent of like studying a volcano and then going to map the North Shore volcanic sequence. You know, there might be differences in scale in what you've studied physically as far as the processes in the field, but it does lend some ability to interpret process. And facies is most importantly. And the other thing I've tried to do throughout my career, and I hope that this kind of lends credence to what I'm saying, is talk to a lot of other glacial geologists and glaciologists, see a lot of sections around the world, go to modern glaciers around the world, just to understand kind of the breadth of deposits that we have. And I can tell you that our tills in Minnesota are a little bit odd. They're more like the tills in the Dakotas than they are the tills of farther east. They look like the tills of Seattle. They look like the tills of the Baltic area. But elsewhere, tills are usually more crumbly and coarse-grained. So we have kind of unusual tills. Just a quick definition. Till actually is from the Gaelic, and it means like a freshly plowed field. So that makes sense. But it is a deposit that is a product of glacial erosion, transport, and deposition. If anything's happened to it since it was deposited by a glacier, you should probably call it something else, like a debris flow. And the inherent variability in the way it's deposited does make it difficult to sample and characterize and classify. So you have to kind of understand the scale of what you want to understand and then design your sampling strategy for that scale. And in Minnesota, tills in the subsurface, because we have that long record of glaciation, have also been subject to several glacial cycles, which means that they can become compacted over time, and also soil development and periglacial processes. So they might actually have some old fractures or weakness in the surface that then becomes buried by a new glacial layer. So I'm going to show lots of different pictures of till just before I put lists on the board so you can just get a sense of the difference in tills. This is a late phase superior lobe till in Carlton County. With each phase of the superior lobe, the tills got clayier. They started in the Twin Cities area as being kind of a sandy loam. And these, I'm using soil terminology and thinking of the texture triangle when I do it. Sandy loam is kind of down in the left-hand corner. Loamy sand is similar, but varying percentages of sand, that, you know, it really is a precise terminology. But up in Carlton County, because the ice retreats and advances over lakes that are impounded in front of it, each phase gets clayier until the till of the Superior lobe up on the North Shore, it's hard to tell from a lake clay of Lake Superior. So the textures vary significantly. So if you really want to be careful about classifying a till, like if you're out describing a log, or coring into a landfill, or, you know, just looking at an outcrop, it helps to understand the lithology and the texture. the Geological Survey atlases do these components very well. They describe the different lithology of the clasts, sometimes even the lithology of the clay minerals, and then the texture of the matrix in sand, silt, and clay ratios. And then the survey also helps you understand what the stratigraphic position and relative age of these tills are. That's great because these are hard things to do if you don't have a broad framework, if you're working on a site. And then mode of deposition and linking facies characteristics to the process that deposited the till. That gets a little harder, and it gets a little harder with each buried layer down because you're missing some of the clues that might have helped you understand the facies. And then I think it's also helpful to have hydraulic and engineering behavior of tills. This is something that's more typically done maybe by the DNR when they're developing these models, but more likely by consulting and engineering firms that are trying to really understand a site, because these tend to be site-specific types of features. And I want to emphasize also that diamicton is not a dirty word. In my book, drift is a dirty word, because drift refers back to the concept that all glacial sediment was deposited by Noah's flood. So if you're using that, it's an archaic term. Overburden also bugs me, but diamicton is just a non-genetic word for a sediment that is a mixture, dye, of two different grain sizes. So if you're not sure, if you're in the subsurface and it looks kind of like a till, but you don't know if a glacier deposited directly or if it has been modified, diamicton is the word you should be using. It just means there's a bimodal distribution, there's a matrix, there's clasts in the matrix, and it's an appropriate term. So for anything that with rocks suspended in a matrix, so a landslide deposit, colluvium, these are diamictons as well. Debris flows are diamictons. If it becomes a rock, it's a diamictite. And sometimes you just are lazy and use diamict, or that means rock or non-rock. So that these are good terms to use in the same way that you might use gravelly sand instead of stream sediment. So there are classification approaches that differ, and I'm going to get away from the terminology, but I just want to make sure that this is very clear starting out. But let's look at how complex this deposit is first. So, I mean, these are the kind of things you might be faced with at the surface in a morainic area where you can kind of understand, because it's in a hill or some kind of a hummocky landscape, that you're going to have variable textures. If this is in the subsurface, you're going to just go crazy trying to classify this thing, because you'll be drilling through blocks of gravel that are bedded and rotated, and then diamicton areas surrounding it. Glaciers do this too. So a classification approach, the logs that I see and I like to read coming from engineering firms and like MnDOT are very lithologic in their descriptions. You can tell they're not imparting any kind of interpretation. Those logs also kind of put me to sleep after a while, because they do tend to be a little repetitive, maybe overly complex. But they're conveying a lot of information if you can stay focused. A genetic log might emphasize the facies characteristics and the environment of deposition over a description of the materials. And that can be problematic if they just leap to a conclusion, or if they're not filling you in on kind of the details of what they're seeing. So I tend to prefer descriptions that have a combination of both of these things, and make sure to hit key distinguishing features. What is the grain size distribution, not just of the matrix, but of the clasts, because that's important in some cases. The particle morphology, are these rounded, are they angular? There's just the typical sedimentary description techniques. Fabric, any internal structures like folds or faults, and the dimensions of the unit. I emphasize this in outcrop scale with students, and the nature of the contacts, because I want to know if you expect this to be laterally extensive across a gravel pit, or if it's just a little block, and if the contacts are conformable or not, if they're erosional contacts. That all means something for expected continuity of these units. So back to just the lithofacies. Lithofacies would be a gravelly sand with cobbles. The DNR aggregate mapping program is really good about describing sand and gravel really well with precise use of terms. Pebble or sand is different than a granule, which is different than a pebble, which is different than a cobble and a boulder. These all have specific size ranges that you probably use this to in the gravel industry. You might say in a genetic terminology that's a braided stream, braided glacial stream sediment, or you might just use a term that's shorthand for you, outwash, but doesn't necessarily convey a lot to the non-informed user. So I tend to avoid the words in the right-hand column and use a combination in map description labels of first describing the lithofaces very carefully and then adding my interpretation at the end so that it's the last thing in the unit definition. It can be discarded, or that might not even be important to a person. So just some other examples, and this background picture is not a till. That is a varved lake sediment that was developed in front of the superior lobe. So now to the processes. There are three principal substrates that a glacier is going to be moving over, and we can ignore probably two of those, so I'll go quickly through those. There are places in the center of the Laurentide ice sheet and in the centers of current ice sheets where it looks like the ice was completely frozen to the ground and there was no motion at all, no differential motion. There's even relic landscapes preserved that existed prior to glaciations in the centers of ice sheets. So there's not any geomorphic work happening there. The ice may be deforming slowly, but there's no sliding happening at the bed. So we can ignore that. The unfrozen rock bed. This would be if you go to the Alps or if you go to the Canadian Rockies, Alaskan glaciers in a lot of cases, you have ice in direct contact with hard rock, and it is sliding. We can probably ignore that unless you're working in the boundary waters. But what we have most in Minnesota is an unfrozen, unlithified sediment bed. So we had glaciers, even the first glaciers, were coming in over sedimentary rock and thick saprolite. So they were dealing with the ice not impacting rock, but the ice coming over a sediment that actually could deform. And that actually affected the way our ice moves quite a bit. So I'm afraid that most glacial classes study these unfrozen rock beds because that was the classic example in glacial geology. Glacial geology evolved in the Alps with Swiss glaciers and German glaciers, and the people that studied them worked very hard to understand the physics of ice moving over rock. A material scientist at Northwestern, when I was there, Hans Wertmann, had to kind of simplify things and have a little cubic obstacle at the bottom of a glacier, and he modeled the flow of ice around cubes. They call it Wertmann's tombstones now. But these examples, if you had a class that was focused on erosion by plucking and abrasion, creating smooth striated landforms like Roche-Montagnes, and producing debris like silt by crushing, because that's the smallest grain size you can really crush something to. Clay is more of a mineral. And that debris was then incorporated into the ice and transported. That's the classic example that is not really the way things worked here. Now, again, it may be relevant in northeast Minnesota, and I'm going to show you this area. The boundary waters formation up in the boundary waters is a different kind of till than we see elsewhere in Minnesota, very locally derived. Looks like this, big rocks that are very local in their origin. But even there, we suspect, this is Terry Borboom standing on a core stone, even there we believe that there was a thick saprolite originally, and that the glacier that came into that area has mostly just removed that saprolite and rolled those core stones a little bit from where they started out. Core stones are chemical weathering products of pre-Cretaceous weathering. So most likely, you don't have to think about that kind of glacial process. But if you do go there, what you see is till that was incorporated into the ice in little thin layers, and then gradually melted out as either by friction of melting at the glacier bed with these grains just coming in one by one and lodging on the substrate, or the ice not moving anymore and that stuff passively melting out. Those are really fragile kinds of till that are deposited sometimes in cavities under the glacier by stagnant or slow-moving ice at the edge. They're very poorly consolidated, and texturally they vary quite a bit. And are fairly low density. So if we have those in Minnesota, they might be the last thing that's covering our subglacial till package. But otherwise, our subglacial till is mostly created in a different way. So the typical Des Moines lobed, whoops, oh, I totally lost a figure there. Bummer. I think I'll get something else. The typical Des Moines lobe till, you can actually count a handful of sand grains in it and trace a layer all the way across the state based on the texture of the matrix and the lithology of the sand grains. So this is very different than a locally derived till that's melting out. This is something that's created up in Canada here and is brought in as a paste and or a putty and spread across the landscape. So the way you form a very uniform layer of till like this, uniform at the macro scale, is by, and here we have our lobes down in the Dakotas and Minnesota, Des Moines lobe and James lobe. You start making it up here somewhere. You start making it in Saskatchewan. And you actually are doing a lot of, beginning a lot of the incorporation of materials there, and then essentially transporting it to the edge of the ice sheet to where these ice lobes project, and then depositing it from then on. Not to say that there isn't any further incorporation as you go down, but we can trace the origin of some of our lithologies all the way up to here in the ice sheet. Similarly, for the superior lobe, this one kind of stops short at the border, but we can trace things far, far up into the Laurentide ice sheet for each of the lobes of the Great Lakes. So they are the expressions of these ice streams that gradually work their way far up into the ice, and they will create a path of exotic material over the bed that they're moving over. So they're actually creating a carpet of material that allows them to continue to advance, and I'll go into that a little bit more. These are the paths of ice streams in Canada, and there's a scale bar here. And in fact, there's a couple different cross-cutting paths of different ages there. So the way glacial geologists and glaciologists have conversed in the last 30 years has been through forums like the International Glaciological Society, Midwest meetings, glaciologists who are at the universities in this upper Midwest area who are talking to glacial geologists, and glaciologists who were focused on understanding the dynamics of the ice streams of West Antarctica because they were concerned about the decay of the West Antarctic ice sheet, but also intrigued by how the ice was moving. And you can see that what happens in Antarctica, this is actually colored by velocity. So some of these dark blue areas are moving 5 kilometers a year. That's much faster than you think. It's much faster than ice can deform. So there's something else allowing these ice streams to move. And the other thing we understand about them is that they start off as little short stubby things at the coast here in Antarctica. For us, it would have been at the edge of the Laurentide ice sheet. And then they gradually work their way up into the ice sheet, just as a dendritic drainage system would work its way up into a watershed, capturing more and more of the ice shed, draining more of the ice out through them. And as they evolve, they bring farther and farther sourced material to their corridors of fast ice flow. And this is not as mysterious a process anymore because people have drilled through these ice streams and water has squirted out when they've hit the bottom. And then they've also been able to see that underneath the ice there is this layer of deforming till. And that's actually what's facilitating the fast flow. It's saturated or high water pressure, and the till is actually a moving carpet that is allowing this ice to move so quickly. And the more ice you capture, the more subglacial water you capture, the more friction you develop, and it's a positive feedback that drains an ice sheet of its volume. So the ice lobes that we have here are expressions of the drawdown of the Laurentide ice sheet. And that means that these unfrozen, unlithified sediment beds are key areas for study right now. Neil Iverson at Iowa, who was a grad student the same time as me at the U, this is a very active area of research for him. And he looks at very physical processes like geothermal heat coming up to the bed of the till layer, that heat being convected out, how much heat is added by friction, what the shear force is. the flow of water and solutes through this. I mean, this is an incredibly active area of research, and he actually does it physically with a ring shear device. He packs this machine with till and shears it to very high strains to try to understand the signatures that you would see in a sediment that would help you understand how much strain it went under. So very much like structural geology, you know, if you're looking at fault gouge and you're trying to figure out how much strain has a certain mineral undergone. It's confusing, and I love this picture of how confused everybody looks. These are big deal glacial geologists, Paul Hoffman, who kind of figured out that the whole Earth was covered with ice at one point during the Precambrian, John Shaw, David Sharp from the Canadian Geological Survey, Tracy Brennan. They're kind of big names in the research area, but we are still really hammering out what till means when we see it and what are the diagnostic features. To be fair, and that's Roger Hook up at the outcrop, that's what they are looking at. And that's a crazy section in the Seattle area where the rip-up clasts, if that's what they are, of lake sediment, are that enormous, embedded by this structureless gravel, and then there's a decoulement here, at least erosional profile, with the till on top. You know, these are, you know, some big burst of water under the glacier ripped up those clasts, and then the glacier surged out through the Puget Sound, possibly. That was the story. So in both fields, subglacial traction is really the key issue. So how stuck is the glacier to its bed? And if it's stuck to the bed, how much of the bed is it dragging along? So for glaciologists, this is key because they're trying to model the flow of ice, and they need to understand what's actually deforming. Are we getting most of our velocity from the deforming ice or the sliding of the ice over a layer? Or is the sliding impeded somehow by things that are plowing into the substrate and slowing it down, like boulders that are sticking out? And if it is dragging along some of its substrate, how much is it dragging along, and how is that deforming? And glacial geologists care about this because this deforming layer is our till record. And whether it's carried along, that means it's eroding, and it's eroding at the base of the deforming layer. Or whether the glacier stops deforming so much, that means till's deposited from the base of the layer up. So it's a completely different paradigm. You can just think of this as the shear zone of the glacier with its bed, and then how much shear gouge do you actually have down there. And this is where the mixing is occurring, and this is where you might see evidence of deformation, either brittle deformation if it's kind of drying out, or ductal deformation if it's a wet, sloppy mess down there. Or maybe nothing. Totally high strain rates are going to give you the best mixed till that there is. So here's an example from the Watonwan River down by Garden City. And I wish you could see that a little better. Is there a way to dim the lights at the front of the room? Because this is kind of cool. There's a gravel under here, and there's a zone of mixing right here that's about 10 centimeters thick that has little pods of gravel incorporated into it. And then there's a fairly stark boundary here, but it's the same color till as above. So that is the deforming layer of this glacier. That's how much it's incorporated from below. This is how much it's brought in from afar. That's the exotic component. So that the observations that have been made in Minnesota and in many places suggest that the deforming horizon is fairly thin. Usually a half a meter is all that can be supported. And this is also documented by the types of experiments that Neil Iverson does. And it's common to find drag folds and shear folds in that lower portion and incorporation of local material in the bottom portion. And then deformation, if you see deformation at greater depths, that's been interpreted as stacking of shear packages. So the deforming horizon has kind of moved up and down through the sediment beneath the glacier. So here's a cartoon sketch of that general situation where you see rafts of incorporated material, sometimes bedrock. Sometimes these rafts are large enough that a building that will not be named was actually footed in it on 394. You know, big rafts of limestone that feel like they should be bedrock. And then that gets gradually incorporated into the lower till, folded and stretched and folded and stretched. Sometimes there will be a pronounced decoulement with kind of the the more mixed and exotic till. If the deforming horizon is moved up, you'll see that pronounced décollement, pronounced to a glacial geologist maybe. And then you might still see remnant lenses of the material that was incorporated below. That doesn't mean water flowed through there. It just means that it's still being mixed into the till. And then stuff can happen later at the top. So here's an example of this kind of bed deformation a little farther from here on Lake Erie in New York. This is a Devonian shale that actually has been, there's a camera for scale, Devonian shale that's actually been dragged up and folded and then completely brecciated in this unit down to little centimeter-sized pieces, still just all local shale, though. And then there's the décollement with the more exotic till. So this is most likely if you have the high water pressure in the sediment. And it does depend on texture, so you can have high water pressure persist longer if you have fine-grained sediment in the matrix, so clay and silt. And it happens when the sediment is weaker than the bond between the ice and the bed of the glacier, or its bed. And it also destroys any incipient drainage that might strengthen this material below and drain some of the pore water. So if you can keep it deforming, again, it's a positive feedback because you're not able to expel the water from that deforming layer. So some of the signatures of these subglacial shear zones, when it becomes kind of brittle, you'll see little tiny micro shear planes like this. So I call it fissile, you know, like a shale is fissile. Howard Hobbs liked to write hackly in his descriptions of cores. So if you see that word in his logs or cores, it's a hackly till. But it's just, it breaks along these tiny little planes that are subhorizontal. But high total strain will produce a till that looks completely mixed. So there's actually three different layers here, maybe different shear packages. That one is pretty clear, but there's one right here. There's more than three in this zone. That's Al Knabley's head for scale. Swimming. And, you know, they look massive and they look uniform, but if you look closely, and I admit till is one of the uglier sediments around, but if you spend some time looking at them, you can start to subdivide it into layers that are at least these shear packages and possibly different members of a formation as identified by the MGS. Sometimes it's easy to see these processes. And in the Twin Cities, if we still had exposures of the Twin Cities formation, I would take you there and you would believe this because the contrast in color is so great. In fact, are there any still in your, Lewis, in your gravel pits exposed? Ask Lewis. One, he's got one exposure. They're like in the outer ring suburbs and they get built up really quickly. But if they're exposed in gravel pits like up by Maple Grove, you might still be able to see them. But the superior lobe, the bottom color in this, it was advanced over by the Grantsburg sublobe. And the Grantsburg sublobes, as it crossed the moraine of the superior lobe, started to incorporate that red material. And so you can see the drag folding, and you can see the long, strung-out folds that are relaxed, and the noses of the folds, you can trace them out, and you can start to believe in this process of how local material is sometimes incorporated and admixed, and how it's all happening at the base of the till layer. That's not my alarm for quitting. Okay, so till fabrics. Let me talk about till fabrics. And this is not a great picture of a till fabric because that's actually a debris flow in the Iron Range pit. So there is some weak alignment of pebbles in that. Can you kind of see that? I'm pointing to it. Kind of chipping downhill there. That's till fabrics are vague like that. And you might have to pull out a lot of pebbles and measure their long axes and count them. But till fabrics are also a real thing. Because deformation, if you think about a shear zone, it causes preferred orientation of particles. So the long axis will often be parallel to the shearing direction and tipped slightly up, just like imbricate pebbles in a stream. It's the same kind of physical process. But they can also be transverse and kind of be rolling like logs in a shear zone. If they're really prolate, really long cigar-shaped clasts, they can orient like that. They also will roll like cartwheel through a shear zone in some cases, and so you might be catching them in the middle of that cartwheel, and so the fabric might not be very strongly developed in some cases. So there are variable strengths of fabrics that can be measured, And it does depend on the porosity and the water and the density and everything. And this is the kind of thing Neil Iverson is physically trying to model in that ring shear device, and others are trying to document. But with sufficient strain, you will get these very strong flow parallel fabrics. And I hope you're thinking already in your head, what does it mean for hydraulic conductivity? Because it does alter the way water moves through sediment if you have strong flow parallel fabrics. And I want to show you that these fabrics are at all scales. So these are the drumlins of Donegal Bay in the northern part of southern Ireland. And I'm going to show you an outcrop in the coast of one of these drumlins here. This is the outcrop in the drumlins. And this is a till not unlike ours. I guess the difference is that all the clasts look like they're about the same rock type. So this glacier advanced over one main rock type, these dark rocks. But the clasts are kind of nice for seeing what the fabric is. And Willie Warren's nose is kind of pointing in the direction of the till fabric here. So the tills are aligned, and the striations on the rocks are aligned with the till's long axis, and the drumlins are aligned with that same direction. So, you know, this is all a product of subglacial shear. Everything's getting oriented in the direction of glacier flow. Down to the, and I want to point out one other thing. These might be shear packages. This is how subtle they would be. There's a slight distinction there and there, and another one here. So that's kind of how a shear package might present an outcrop. It's a very, very subtle thing. And this alignment of clasts goes all the way down to the micromorphology. Glacial geologists, this is the work of John Menzies and Jaap Vandermeer. I don't know if Caleb's in the room, but he was a student of one of John Menzies. But they developed this process of micromorphology, looking at actually the grains in a thin section of till to understand the origin of that till. And they've developed a process for identifying all the little micro fractures, the rotational features of these small grains of sand that are rotating. I think they call them galaxy structures. And I took a short course in this thinking I would apply it, and I don't think it's my cup of tea, but it does work. I mean, it is a technology that works. So just to recap for now, glacial till is the result of potentially deposition alone if it's a melt-out till, just release from the ice, but more likely deformation as well, and most likely a combination of deposition and deformation, and that's the kind of where I think we are with our tills in Minnesota. I tend to call them subglacial traction tills to indicate that they're being dragged along and that they are subject to both shear and gravitational forces, and this is one of the things that makes them dense, unusually dense, the combination of shear and the gravitational forces of the ice on it. And really, it boils down to what that effective pressure situation is at the bottom of the glacier. And in the glacial geology class I teach at the U, and again, it's offered this fall if this is interesting you, I start with the subglacial water environment because it's really what's happening with the water at the bottom of the glacier that affects the kind of till record that we get. And I want you all to think of the glacier as being saturated like the groundwater saturates the land, because there's a water table in the ice. The water table, sometimes it's confined down here and under pressure, and if you drill into it, it squirts out. Sometimes there is perched water on the top, but more often the glacier is saturated up to a certain point, and that water expresses itself at the surface in lakes and rivers and, you know, fountains in some cases, and also squeezing out from the bottom. The other kind of an interesting thing about the water table and what drives the potentiometric flow in the glacier is that it's a combination of the pressure of the ice, the slope of the bed, and then the pressure of the water under there. So it's a little more complicated. The contours aren't going to be like groundwater contours exactly. But the pressure of the bottom is from the normal pressure of the glacier and then the upward force of flotation of the water pushing back. So if you get too much pressurized water down here, you're essentially going to almost float your glacier above most of its obstacles, and it will slide. And when it's sliding, it's abrading rock potentially if it has any tools in it, grains of sand. But otherwise, it's not really doing much as far as depositing till. So high water pressure situations, fountains do happen on glaciers. Even the earliest whaling ships recognize fountains around the coast of Greenland, water just squirting out. Those are cases where you probably are close to flotation. I'm not saying the ice is going to like lift up and float away, but it's really there's very little normal force on the bed and very little shear that's happening down there, because the water is trapped at the glacier bed and you're decoupling in areas. You can get a little lodgment or plowing and abrasion, but minor. But if you have low effective pressure at the glacier bed, and this is just a small tunnel really compared to some of the ones we had in Minnesota, the glacier's really impacting the bed there where it's well drained. You know, it's feeling the full weight of the glacier there, maybe to the point where it actually is stagnating because it really doesn't have the driving force to move anymore once you remove that cushion of water or the saturated sediment. But low effective pressures, if parts of the bed are better drained, the bed feels the weight of the glacier, the till deforms, and this can change locations over time. And in fact, the best example I saw for a model of Drumlin formation actually had to do with this, this concept. A lot of the drumlins in Wisconsin are cored with sand and gravel and in the Green Bay drumlin field. And that's a slightly better drained part of the bed, meaning it's a little stiffer, and the glacier can't really handle that, so it's going to actually be deforming the till around it and maybe shaping that core of gravel to provide less resistance to flow, streamlining it as it goes. And that can shift over time. It can shift even once you start to form a field of drumlins. That can cause it to shift. So I can lead you to that paper if you're interested. But what this means to us is that when we do drain the bed, either through these half-mile-wide tunnel valleys, as you see here in Pine County, carved into the Hinckley Sandstone, or through little tiny canals that are just like bigger than a rugby ball, filled with sand and gravel, you know, you're locally changing the pressure of the water in that sediment and at the glacier bed. So this is important. I'm going to sum up. This is an outcrop of till on the Le Sueur River, south of Mankato. I should say more than one till. How many do you see there? And again, I wish the light were better. I'm following the joints to figure out how many tills. And I see there's a little lake sediment on the top here. I'm going to ignore that. But I see some joints going down to here and stopping. And then I see a layer that's not jointed here. And then I see the joints going down to there. This, I think, could be erosion by the stream, but I'm going to say there's at least one, two, three here, three different layers. These joints are important to you, and that's what I'm going to kind of finish with, is the density of tills. The theoretical maximum density ranges between 1.92 and 2.3 if you assume a particle density initially as the average particle density of rocks, 2.65, and actual densities in the field. If you measure them in situ for these subglacial traction tills, they're similar to this range. And let me just back up. I mean, that's probably at the higher end, and that section of rock is behaving, or that section of till is behaving like rock. In fact, when we were modeling the incision of that part of the Le Sueur River watershed, we had to model it as if it were a rock unit eroding, because that's how it was behaving. Sediment didn't work. And often it doesn't disaggregate very easily. Here it does look like it's disaggregated, but often you'll just have a block of rock like dimicton falling into the stream, and then it takes a year or two for that to actually contribute sediment to the stream. So the hydraulic conductivity of a unit like that might be related to its density, but you have to consider the other factors. So what is the function of the fabric of that unit? And then as you saw from that example, the total permeability is likely to exceed because these matrix-dominated tills often have joints, and that's going to allow passage of water through those joints. They tend to close at about 12 meters depth. But I've seen cores of till from southwestern Minnesota where at 130 feet or more, there were joints that had been filled with gypsum. So they were open at one point, filled with some mineral that was in the fluids running through it, and then, you know, acting maybe closed now, maybe not permeable now, but still you could dissolve the gypsum out and reactivate those joints. So these matrix-dominated tills are the least permeable. If you have a clast-dominated till, and we tend to get those farther north in Minnesota, or anything that was melting out or on top of the glacier, then it's going to have different conductivities and lenses of more permeable material. And this is the triangular diagram I was talking about that you see on all of the MGS plates. Sand's here, silt is here, clay is there. These matrix-dominated tills tend to fall in this part of the triangle, in the loams, the maybe a clay loam, sandy loam. Another thing that irks me is people calling tills clays. You know, they even if it's 50% clay, it does feel like a clay if it's 50% clay. I mean, if you're texturing it and you know the soil weight of doing it, it's hard to discern 50% or greater clay. But our tills are not clays, except in rare cases like in the Superior Lobe, in the very close margin of the Lake Superior Basin, where it's hard to distinguish from a clay. We have a lot of tills in these sandy loam and loamy sand categories down here. And so the permeability there, if you can't read it, is 10 to the minus 7th. Matrix-dominated tills, 10 to the minus 9th. These are measured in the UK, but they're similar to here, I believe. We might hear it differently later. And finally, just to wrap up with stagnant ice, this is where the rules kind of change. And we can only really recognize these stagnant ice deposits very well at the surface because it's the landforms that kind of give away what a stagnant ice deposit looks like. This was a picture that Herb Wright took in the 50s when he flew to Antarctica as one of the first scientists to go down there to just see what was happening in Antarctica. And this is a little tiny shadow of till. The glacier's flowing on this side and on this side actively, but in the shadow of this bedrock mountain, the till has stagnated. And we can tell it's stagnated because it's covered with debris in the same way that the snow in March was covered with debris in all the parking lots. You know, it was throughout the snow pile, but it concentrates on the surface as you remove the snow by melting. And so if you go out and look at unswept parking lots right now, you get a good idea of what stagnant ice deposits are like. They are basically the slop that moves around on the surface of a differentially wasting mass of ice, falls into the nearest hole that might be water-filled, might not, and they accumulate in those depressions on the ice surface, which means that they leave mounds in the ultimate landscape. And this is an ice-walled lake plain near my house between Elko New Market and Lonsdale, and there's a lot of them down there on the eastern margin of the Des Moines Lobe. They're flat-topped lake sediment, diamicked on the sides, collapsed till sides, and they're hard for people to manage because they don't expect to have to put a sump pump in their house if they build on the top of that hill. Down in Albert Lea, they're smaller. Here's the one-mile section line for scale. These are the rims of ice-walled lake plains. You can tell they're rims that are slightly coarser, sandier. They're not holding as much moisture. And there's just a lot of them because that whole side of the lobe stagnated. This is an early paper on the distribution of some of these. Every single black dot, starting in the Dakotas and into Wisconsin, represents a place where there is stagnant ice with a mound of ice-walled lake sediment. We didn't include Illinois in this picture because at the time this paper was written, they didn't believe in them, but they've come around now. And they started finding them. They call them DeKalb mounds. So what we normally have in the margins of our glacier, sometimes in the 50-mile wide zone at the edge of an ice lobe, is a place where enough debris accumulated on the surface of the glacier that's controlling the expression of the edge of the ice sheet, these lumps of material that fell into the holes on the glacier surface. And likely it stagnated in part because the tunnel valleys, which are expressed here, really drained effectively that outer margin of the glacier, released it of the ability to flow, you know, took away its deforming layer by draining all the water out. And so we have these stagnant margins. Beneath that, you will see the dense subglacial traction till that I've been talking about. That should be fairly uniform, but fairly thin across most of the glacier bed. So if you get out of town west of New Prague and start traveling across like Sibley or Nicollet counties, that's where you're going to see the bed of the Des Moines Lobe and the rather thin tills. On the margins from New Prague to Northfield, basically, you're going to see those thick sections of stagnation material. You know for sure you're looking at a glacier bed if you have Drumlin. So if you're up in the Toyme Drumlin Field in Minnesota or the Wadena Drumlin Field, that is the glacier bed. You will break a lot of augers drilling through those dense tills. And anything can happen on the surface of buried stagnant ice that can happen on the surface in Minnesota in March. And it's very much like that when we still have frost in the ground, but it's thawed at the surface. And it's wet because there's water perched above the frost layer. So you can have lakes, you can have rivers, they can be temporary. You can get more debris flows like we did on Highway 169 if the frost isn't out yet. And it's an active surface. You don't have to know the ice is under there to colonize it as these trees in Alaska do. They're called the drunken forest because they move around as the debris on the ice moves around. Birds and animals will sit in these ponds. We know our ice walled lakes had pill clams and ostracods and little shrubby tundra species growing around them because of the stuff that has fallen into them. So stagnant ice was everywhere in the margins of the lobes in the mid-continent, and you can expect this loose, very hard-to-predict layer on top of everything else. And you can recognize it by the hummocky topography, if you're lucky. In the subsurface, you're just going to see a lot of discontinuous units, and it's going to be a little harder to predict. So I want to conclude with the words of my mentor and advisor, Herb Bright, who ended almost every sentence with, "It's all very complex." I couldn't put a year to this because he said it so often. So thank you. Oops. I'm still attached.
Well, thank you very much, Carrie, for your crash course in glaciology and all things glacial sediment. We have some time for questions, so Kelton?
So most of us are stuck with having to rely upon soil borings rather than outcrops, and at best we get split barrel samples. Do you have any pointers? Are the fabrics preserved well enough in those split barrel samplings? Would you recommend putting liners in to preserve that? Any comments on that?
So how to look for fabrics in split barrel samples. It is hard. In a 4-inch diameter rotorosonic core, you can see them a little bit. But I should mention that vibration relaxes the packing of most overconsolidated glacial sediment. Sometimes we would drill 10 feet rotorosonic into a till unit that was very dense and get 15 feet of recovery from the relaxation. So that does happen. You still could see some potential fabrics there. I don't know how much vibration is involved in that method. Yeah, pounding. It might work. You know, I think a good way to infer subglacial tills is blow counts and just general density. And I think that's the proxy that you would probably look for in a small-scale sample.
So I have two brief questions, Carrie.
Yes.
First of all, diamicton is not a dirty word, but what about triamicton? Because, you know, we have like three corners of the triangle. Is that a word?
Well, all of those corners refer to the matrix. So the textures that you see from the geological survey, they're washing out all the gravel. They're taking away the gravel, screening it out.
Geez.
They're just doing the matrix texture.
Okay, never mind.
If you dial down into their data, you can see the percent gravel, which you might want to do because it varies a lot between the Rainy Lobe and the Des Moines Lobe.
Yeah, I was just kidding around. But still, the other question I had is, I wonder if anybody has ever seriously applied some of the concepts you talked about to, I hate to say it, the driftless area.
There is no driftless area in Minnesota.
Well, that spot kind of where there's less of it.
Has been glaciated, yes.
Okay. Whatever word you want to use, and the underdrainage that's provided by those nice karstic aquifers there.
You know, that was something that Howard Hobbs speculated on, that the incision of the Mississippi River and the karst potentially does drain the subglacial environment. And there are models that do show differences in glacier behavior depending on what the substrate is. So it makes sense to me that that could happen. But the driftless area of Wisconsin, which is truly driftless, you know, all of Minnesota was glaciated. I say this again and again for Bill Zanner, who fought this until his death. But I think there's other reasons for Wisconsin not being glaciated in the Southwest, and part of that is the glaciers had to cross Lake Superior. And although Lake Superior was deepened successively with each glaciation, it was a deep barrier initially as well because of structural reasons. And so ice coming straight south into Wisconsin had to fill that first and then advance. And during each glacial cycle, Paul Cutler modeled this from University of Wisconsin-Madison, it just was hard for ice to cross that. It tended to calve and have icebergs and not take a whole glacial cycle until it could get close. So that's more the reason. And so all of Wisconsin, all of Minnesota was glaciated the last time around. The glacial border is west of the southeast corner of Minnesota and the southwest corner of Minnesota, but there are tills at the surface in those areas. And there are tills stuffed down into the caves and glacial sands and gravels in the caves, so you can't discount the effect there. And even the paraglacial effect of the Des Moines Lobe being at basically I-35 and having these katabatic winds depositing loess all across southeast Minnesota. Significant effect, too. Yeah, so till's not clay. There is no driftless area in Minnesota. Dimecton is not a dirty word. Three key messages.